The Pew Research Center just gave us the numbers to back up what we already know. The vast majority of us have cell phones, and they're with us most of the time.
What isn't so clear is the going standard for when it's okay to use them. So Pew surveyed 3,200 people to find out when they think it's okay to use your cell phone. If we think of etiquette as a form of societal consensus, the survey tried to shed some light on what passes for polite nowadays.
Here to go through some of the findings with us and share her own thoughts is Amy Elkin. She's a science-based syndicated advice columnist and the author of the book, Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F Word. Amy, welcome back.
Thank you.
So one finding, the number of us who think it's okay to stare at your phone while you're walking down the street, I guess meaning you're not making eye contact with people, you might fall off the sidewalk, stumble. 80% of people think that that is okay. That's a huge majority. What do you make of that result?
Well, this is why I think it's wrong that we determine etiquette by consensus, because that's just rude. Pull over. It's basically like driving and being on your phone, you know, because you're going to bump into people. And actually, David Carr, who is the late media columnist from the New York Times, he used to just walk head on into people doing that as a form of, I guess, vigilante mannersism.
Well, that opens up a big question. We're in, obviously, this time of change with our technology. We've got all our new stuff. You're suggesting we shouldn't just stumble into an etiquette. We should think this through, it sounds like.
Exactly. So at the root of manners is empathy. Is this thing that I am doing to you going to bother you, hurt you, be very unkind, etc.? And that's what we need to use to guide our cell phone behavior. And the reason we need to do that, cell phones are just so exciting. We are basically like chimps with an info nuke in our hands when we have a cell phone. And so we need to pre-plan not to sort of go with our worst impulses.
So overall, Amy, what did you make of the results of this survey when you looked at what people did and didn't think was okay?
Well, I'm not surprised, because people think what's okay is what they're doing, so they don't have to think poorly of themselves. But I really think that we need to be more thoughtful than that and to be more empathy-directed. For example, you know, to be in a restaurant on a date, on a texting on your phone, I just think that is so terrible. The other person, they have to look into their napkin pretending to be looking for secret messages, because it's so embarrassing to be with the person who's doing that to you.
I've been wondering if maybe the next step in etiquette is if you're going to do this in a certain situation, you're going to look at your smartphone or something, you excuse yourself or say, hey, I'm sorry, I need to look at this thing. Or maybe even, do you mind if I check my messages to see if this important one came in? Does that give us a little bit of an out or acknowledging that what we're doing is maybe a bit rude?
Yes, that's very good advice, and I actually advise that. But the thing is, important can't be anything you could possibly get, including spam. important needs to be, my child has a fever, and I need to just make sure that the babysitter says she doesn't need to be hospitalized. You know, or if the liver that you're supposed to install in someone might be arriving soon, that's cool. You know, the other stuff, just this, you know, I got to check the scores, that's mean.
Well, this one should please you then, Amy. Here's some more results from that survey. Phone use during meetings at work, maybe, or a church service, or other sort of pay attention types of scenarios. 94% of people said, no, it's not okay. Although I have a hard time believing that 94% of people don't ever do it, too. It's kind of a... What do you think about those results? Encouraging?
No, because I think all those 94% of the people think very highly of themselves and think that, well, I have a reason to do that. The speaker is boring or whatever. And I don't know, you've probably spoken in front of groups. There's nothing worse than looking down and seeing a bunch of people not paying attention. You think, oh, my God, I'm so boring. I should leave. And people don't really think of the human factor like that. How are they making the speaker feel, the preacher feel, whomever feel, who is the audience for their looking down into their little white wireless binky?
Well, maybe they're out there transcribing every single word the speaker is saying, and that's a sign of great respect.
Oh, okay. I got that okay. One, too. Tom Zellner, who's a professor at Chapman College, he teaches creative writing there, and he said he can always tell when they're transcribing and when they're on Facebook because they're typing at the wrong time. So people do know what you're doing.
We're talking with Amy Elkin right now, science-based syndicated advice columnist and author of Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F-Word. We're digesting now some findings from the Pew Research Center about when most of us think it's okay or not okay to use our cell phones. And Amy, the survey found that women in particular might be more inclined to use their cell phones as a shield. Let's say someone's coming that they don't want to talk to, they feel put upon, they bury their head in their cell phone, and it's an avoidance tactic. What do you think of that? There are societal pressures sometimes that are particular to women. Is it okay for women to do that?
Well, it depends upon the situation, but I would generally say yes, because what this person's trying to do, probably, maybe, is to be kind so they don't have to blow the person off. They can just pretend to be otherwise engaged. And this notion that honesty is the best policy, sometimes deception is a better policy because it's kinder.
Another result, a lot of people said it's okay to use that cell phone, look at your smartphone, do stuff when you're on public transportation, riding a bus, a subway for the places that have subways. And this is one I think I'm behind that. It's no different than if I sit and read a book on a bus or something like that. Are you okay with that one, Amy?
Oh, sure. People have this weird prejudice. Oh, my God, it's new technology. How terrible. In fact, a woman argued, what did she say? It's antisocial to be on your phone when you're walking down the street. And maybe you're talking to somebody who's more important to you than whatever the current environment is. So I call that multisocial and think people should be a little less quick to judge other people's behavior when they don't really know what is going on.
On the other hand, that is something we hear a lot about. We talk a lot about on this radio station about whether, as a society, we're getting less inclined to engage with each other. And some research shows that when we just smile at someone on the street, we get happier, they get happier. But if everyone's on their phone, I guess maybe nobody's happier. Are there risks involved with that?
Well, yes, we do have to pre-plan because you have to think about your phone, have an engaged relationship with it, and think about, do I really want to be on my phone all the time, or might I have some wonderful experiences if I engage? However, not everybody likes to engage. My boyfriend is an introvert. We get to a party, and he'll say, do we really have to go inside? And for people like that, it's wonderful to be able to cocoon themselves, to not have to engage with people all the time because they get, you know, it's sort of painful for them.
Here's another etiquette issue that I've encountered on a bus or hanging out at a restaurant or something like that when somebody else is talking on their cell phone and I get deep insight to the rich inner life, their plans, their legal troubles, their family lawsuits. So how do we handle that issue as the talker and can we intervene if we're the talkee, if we're the bystander there?
Well, it depends. I call this privatizing public space as your own. It is the height of rudeness. People don't realize this, however. I'm going to give you a little science on this. It turns out that a one-sided conversation is more interruptive to the brain than a two-sided one through something called theory of mind, which is our theory of what's in other people's minds. So, for example, if a guy kneels down across the street to ask something of his girlfriend, he's probably not asking her for a pen. And we know this, but this ability to identify what other people are probably thinking is automatic, and that preys on us when people are on their phone calls. However, the problem is if you try to control people, if you try to criticize them, this tends to backfire. Criticizing people does not make them change. It makes them want to clobber you. So the best things to do are to say things like, it's a little loud, or would you mind keeping it down a little? You know, and to not be aggressive and just say, you're so rude, get off your phone, because they're not going to do that. They're going to do whatever they were doing loudly and more profanely than they were.
See, I'm in the minority. I love listening to people's conversations on the phone. It is so interesting. It's a boon to writers, and it makes the bus ride shorter. I mean, they might just be some faceless stranger, but then you know they have a big medical appointment coming up. They had a fight with their spouse. It's so interesting.
In important regards, you and I are very different people.
Yeah, you hear more interesting people than I do. I was at a store the other day. I mean, people are just arranging the times to do things. Got to pick up the dry cleaning when I get home. Wow, fascinating.
Yeah, no, you can't always argue for the content, but sometimes there's good stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe if I could pretend like I was Bob Newhart and I'm filling in the comedian and filling in the other side in humorous ways in my mind, I guess then I could find it more entertaining.
And I do want to answer something you sort of brought up, but maybe it was about restaurants and things. But in the movies, people who are on their cell phones, they know they're being rude and they don't care. So you have to call in a professional. You have to call an usher, because if you tell them to please not do it, they already know they're doing it and don't care. So you're just, it's a futile act on your part.
Outside intervention needed. Good point. Well, we're talking now to science-based advice columnist Amy Alkan about a new Pew study that looked at how people use their cell phones these days. We're getting a snapshot on what does and doesn't pass as good etiquette in the smartphone era.
And we want to hear from you about this. When do you think it is never, ever okay to use your phone? Where do you draw the line? And when have you been most recently irate at someone for misusing their phone at the wrong time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking to advice columnist Amy Alkan about a new Pew study that looks at how people use their cell phones today. We're getting a snapshot of what does and doesn't pass for good etiquette, what's acceptable these days. Amy's the author of the book Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F Word.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are the rules for you? What bugs you when it comes to public cell phone use? Maybe at the dinner table in a public place. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Jordan on the line in Milwaukee. Jordan, hi.
Hi. I just want to say, for me, the worst was when I rode public transportation. Thank God I don't do that anymore. But when I rode public transportation, the worst was when people would play music on their cell phones without headphones.
Ah, okay. So you're not talking, they're listening quietly to themselves on headphones. They're politely sharing their music with their co-passengers.
Yes, like, you know, blaring their music so that you hear it all throughout the bus. And it's like, you know, I don't want to hear, you know, your bad music. I've got bad taste in music. We've all got bad taste in music. I'm sure you don't want to hear my Fleetwood Mac or my Scissor Sisters blaring. So, you know, politely and kindly, please, you know, get some headphones.
Jordan, thanks a lot for that call. And Amy, can we ever break the chain, if I can quote Fleetwood Mac, on playing music loudly on public transit?
Oh, my God, he is so right. Other passengers' eardrums should not be considered shared space. And in terms of the empathy thing I was discussing before about empathy being the root of manners, one thing that we all can do is to do a little test of our headphones to see if they're leaky. That horrible mosquito sound of leaky headphones, angry mosquitoes, to see if that's the case. I mean, you could spend another $10 on your headphones and get a pair that don't leak, because you're probably on public transportation torturing people simply by existing, so you don't need to give them any sound effects to go with.
Jordan, thanks a lot for that call. We're going to go next to Todd in Cross Plains. Todd, hi.
Hi. One thing that really bothered me, I've bartended in the past, right? And there's nothing more annoying than when someone walks up to the bar and they're talking on the phone and they wave to you to come on over to them. I didn't, when I was bartending, I didn't wait on people. I'd wait till they hung up, and they'd usually be upset, and I'd tell them, well, I figured you were on the phone, so I didn't want to interrupt your conversation.
I love that. And you know what? That's right on, because when you let yourself be abused, that opens you up to more and more of it. It is good to tell them so they don't just think that you're rude, to say, I'll get to you when you're off the phone, so they realize, and they're more likely to hop to it then. But really, it's great that you did that, because people need to be trained.
That's right. It's interesting, Amy, that you're promoting that rude does not answer rude. So you should still behave well, even if someone else maybe is not.
Right, because what you don't want to do is let other people create who you are, create your behavior. So that's why, again, it's so important to pre-plan, because we are basically, I mean, we are chimps. We're basically these hot-headed people, hot-headed creatures, and we're liable to get all upset at these situations. And instead, what you need to do is just expect that other people will behave rudely. Then you won't be so mad. And then when they do, you can handle it in a cool way.
Todd, thanks a lot for the call. Jenny is with us next in Rice Lake. Jenny, hi.
I think mine is very similar to your last call. I work in a convenience store, and when they will not put down their cell phone, they will not listen to what I'm saying, they will not pay, they will not do anything until, you know, and they just continue talking. I, as a matter of fact, one time pounded on the counter to get their attention, And it was just ridiculous. And the other customers behind, not only is it rude to me, but the other customers in line get very angry, and they say, why don't you tell him? And I said, I can't because I work here. I said, but you could tell him. I said, I can't stop you. And one gentleman, a woman had was texting, and when he got up to pay, he said, oh, wait a minute, let me get out my cell phone and text a while. And I'm like, yeah, I know. But that, to me, should never happen. You can put your phone down long enough to pay for your purchase.
And Jenny, thanks for the call. Amy, a retail store I used to work at has since posted a sign at the register that says, we won't serve you if you're talking on your cell phone. I don't know if they've amended it to include texting since then yet, though. Should stores have that be a posted policy?
Oh, please, if you're a store owner listening out there, please have that be your policy and support your employees. Otherwise, they're just victimized. They need their job. They can't say what they should say, which is, I'll help the next person who's not all busy on their phone. Because that's the fair thing to them. We should not treat cashiers as these sort of machines with realistic human features. And I learned something in France, and you go through a courtyard of a building, and some woman you have never seen before and will never see again says, bonjour, madame. And that's really nice, and I incorporated that. I'm from the Midwest, from Michigan across the lake. And, you know, I was raised to be decent and friendly. And so now I always talk to cashiers, hi, how are you? God, it's crowded. Hope you're not having a hard day. They really appreciate this, you know, instead of being treated like a thing.
We're talking with Amy Alkin right now, science-based syndicated advice columnist. She's the author of Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F Word. Talking about a new survey from Pew that tells us when people feel it is okay or not okay to use their cell phone. For instance, is it okay to grab your phone and take pictures of stuff in public when you're with other people? Survey says 60% of people do that. They think it's okay. What do you say, Amy?
Well, it really depends. We should not assume that other people's privacy belongs to us, because it does not. Not everybody wants to be in your photo. Now, if you're in a public place, you have a First Amendment right to take pictures. But as for whether you can post mean things, which many people do, about total strangers, if they're a private person, I mean, would you like that to happen to you? There's sort of some simple thoughts that we can go through on that. And I do want to say it is a big problem for restaurants where people do these elaborate food shots. First of all, if you're in some dimly lit, fabulous place, your cell phone flashing is not part of the ambiance that they intend. That ruins it for other people, but also it really slows things down for the kitchen, and it makes their business not as profitable, because it actually does take quite a long time for people often to get through their phone shots of their food, and they'll like back their elbow into another patron. It's kind of awful.
We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Margaret on the line in Milwaukee. Margaret, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is maybe a little bit of a different annoyance than what you're talking about, but I get really annoyed when people expect me to answer my phone because I have it with me.
That is a great point. You know, technology, the ability to answer your phone immediately does not mean it's a mandate. And people need to let other people know their phone policy so they won't be offended. I also will not answer my phone much of the time. It's always on silent if it's with me. If I'm out with someone, I focus on them. So you need to let people know that, and just let them know it's policy and that it doesn't have anything to do with them. They can't just expect you to behave in a way that works for them.
Amy, do you think that where we are right now with this technology is sort of equivalent to the Wild West, that anything goes? We're just figuring this stuff out now, that maybe 5 years from now, maybe 3 years from now, maybe things will have calmed down a little. Maybe people will be a little less intrusive with their phones.
Yes, I really think that's true. And it sort of mirrors what happened with the telephone. Initially, people really didn't know what they were supposed to do. And in fact, Alexander Graham Bell had tried to set up some rules, like that you would answer not hello, but ahoy. It's really weird and never, thankfully, caught on. But I do think that we will start to have pressure the same way we did about people shouting into their phones in public, which you really don't hear as much of anymore, that we will start to have better behavior in texting. For example, in workplaces, some workplaces, and I do suggest this in the book, they have a basket in the middle of the table when they have a meeting, because people are just too tempted to, I'll just check that one thing on Facebook, Cakes or Us or whatever, you know, and they're not paying attention to the person who's talking. So basically the meeting was worthless to some degree. And so that needs to be, things like that need to be thought of to work within human behavior and the bratty ways we behave.
Amy, thanks so much for joining us. Informative, and it's been a lot of fun.
Well, I love talking to you guys.
That was Amy Alkin. She's a science-based syndicated advice columnist and author of the book Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F Word. Still time for you to weigh in over at the Central Time Facebook page. Have you been an offender? Have you used your cell phone in a way and thought, you know what, in hindsight, I shouldn't do that? Or, and you're more likely to answer it this way, what bothers you when other people do it? Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickert, will be back with me on Monday. It's Food Friday. Thanksgiving is over. Maybe you're exhausted from all the prep and the cooking went into the big feast. Maybe you're done with cooking for now. Too much work. Nobody has time on a work week. But wait, Mark Bittman, the author of the best-selling How to Cook Everything series, joins us with a fresh and fast take on cooking great food. He's a New York Times food writer, host of a PBS food series. Mark Bittman's new book is How to Cook Everything Fast. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. Great to be here.
Well, I laid it out a little bit there. A lot of us are juggling work, cooking for the family. Maybe we don't make time for food. So why this book on cooking fast?
Well, I think, you know, what I've found since I wrote the original How to Cook Everything is that people have basically two, well, I guess the best word is excuses for not cooking. One is they say they don't have enough time, and the other is they say they're afraid or they don't know how to do it. And I, you know, I tried to address both of these in How to Cook Everything Fast. The recipes are not only fast, obviously, but it's more than a collection of fast recipes. It's a sort of rethinking of the recipe so that anyone who takes the time and trouble to have the right ingredients can walk into their kitchen and turn on the stove and start cooking right away and get walked step by step through a recipe that's going to work. And it's a little hard to explain without visual cues, but the recipes look unlike other recipes.
Well, I was going to say that, and this is not usually the most exciting part of a cookbook, but the format is different. Can you break that down and explain a little bit about what you try to do with the format to make our cooking more efficient and faster without sacrificing the awesomeness of the food?
Nicely put. You know, we at the beginning, I got together with a team of people, and two were designers, and two were editors, and two were recipe writers and cooks, and then me. And we said, what's the dance? What's it look like when you watch people cook, and how can we describe that to non-cooks? Because current recipes don't do that. Current recipes are these weird blocks of texts that, you know, you have ingredients on the left, and it would make you think that you're supposed to assemble all your chopped onions and sliced tomatoes and minced garlic and picked parsley and so on before you start cooking. But of course, when you look at how real cooks do it, what they do is they walk in the kitchen, they put a pan on the stove, they turn on the fire, they put some olive oil in the pan, they mince some garlic, they put the garlic in the oil, then they chop up some chicken, and then so on and so forth. And that's what we do. We go through the recipe step by step as if you were cooking it. So, you know, there's always, I mean, cooking is the application of heat to food. While that heat is transforming the food from one thing to another, there's time. You always have to wait. There are no 0-minute recipes. So while you're waiting for the olive oil to warm or the garlic to turn blonde or the tomatoes to break down or the chicken to brown or whatever it is, there's always time to do other things. And that's what real cooks do. They put something in the pan and then they get the next thing ready. It's not a get everything ready and then start cooking. It's a cook and prep at the same time. And that's how our recipes are broken down. There's cook and there's prep and there's cook and there's prep and so on down the line.
And then it's laid out real simple. The cooking, you know, turn on, you know, preheat oven or turn on the thing, black text. So while that's going, blue text, chop your garlic or whatever the step is so that it leaps out at you. Okay, I'm waiting for this thing to warm up. I can use this time efficiently to do something else now.
That's perfect, and it is two-color in black and blue, and it makes it really easy if you want to cook with someone else, because you can say to them, you do the stuff that's written in blue, I'll do the stuff that's written in black, or vice versa, and you already have a perfect division of labor. But it, it's also real clear what you should be doing when. You know, this is a sort of an in-joke among cookbook writers, I guess, but one of the most frequently used words in recipe writing is meanwhile. And we determined we were not going to use the word meanwhile in this book, because once you read the word meanwhile, you have done everything that you were supposed to have done meanwhile. But yeah, anyway.
Well, let's step back a bit before we get into more of the hows of cooking fast. Let's get into the why, because a lot of times, like, okay, I don't have much time. I'll open a can of something. I'll make a sandwich. I'll pick up the rotisserie chicken. I'll call takeout. What's the advantage of not doing those things I just listed?
Well, I think the primary reason to cook is that you have control over what you eat, and that once you relinquish that control, you really don't know what's going on. So all the things you just mentioned, I mean, there's nothing wrong with any of them, you know, but if you start to rely on that, you're basically outsourcing how you're fueling your body, how you're replenishing your body. And, you know, I myself would not want to relinquish that much control. And it's only cooking, it's only preparing food by yourself that really gives you full control.
And what are the benefits, then, of that control, of not, as you say, outsourcing our food preparation?
Well, the benefits are that you start with ingredients that are real food, so that if you look at the spectrum of what's sold in the supermarket, you might say 60, 70, or 80% of that stuff is not even real food. So if you want to eliminate things that have 30 ingredients and have, and then some of them are pretty strange and we don't know what they are and so on down the line, you need to stick to the things that really don't have labels, or they have labels with no ingredients on them or three ingredients on them. And that's the universe of real food. And that's, I think, where more and more people want to live. And only by cooking do you really get to live in that universe.
So let's get to a point before we even hit the cutting board and turn on the oven. You look some at our pantry, what we should have, where we should have it. What are a couple of key ingredients that we should have on hand near our cooking zone?
You know, I think in a way, a good pantry has, you know, 150 ingredients in it. I mean, it's not, you know, the key things, obviously, the olive oil, lemons, Parmesan, soy sauce, vinegar, so on down the line. But when you think about it, if you're going to cook, depending on how many flavors you like and what kind of flavors, it really helps to have dozens, if not hundreds, of things in the pantry. That doesn't mean that you need to go out and buy 150 things tomorrow before you can start cooking, but it does mean that a lot of things keep for a long time, and that if you buy spices and you buy condiments and you buy basic building blocks, grains and beans and pastas and things like that, then you have that stuff at your fingertips. And even if you don't have a chance to stop at the store on the way home, you do get to cook some real food from the pantry if you have that well-stocked pantry.
One of my favorite recipes and recipe titles in the book, and this points toward how I cook, you have a recipe, cold peanut noodles with whatever you have. So you've got the basic cold peanut noodles, and you say, hey, if you got some leftover chicken, put that in, or tofu, or cashews, or whatever. So how important is that, knowing how to improvise, getting a basic thing, and then playing with it with whatever you have laying around?
Well, it's important for me to know that, because I'm the guy writing the recipes, and I do know that. It's less important for the people cooking the recipes, because the idea is that I'm helping you. So that is, you know, cold noodles with peanut sauce, you basically need peanut butter. You're going to have noodles, probably. You know, so it's just like you have what you have there, and then whatever you want to garnish it with, as you say, cucumbers or nuts or chicken or whatever's lying around is going to be good. And beginning cooks don't know that. That's why recipes exist, because beginning cooks can't figure that out. And veteran cooks, truly veteran cooks, don't need cookbooks to be told these kinds of things. They know that. So, but that's not who I'm writing for.
Well, the bulk of your bulky book is recipes, and I want to get into a couple of those. You shared one with this orange ricotta pancakes. I think this is the one we're throwing up on the Central Time Facebook page. Could be a good post-Thanksgiving brunch. Tell us about your orange ricotta pancakes.
Well, this is I guess there's a little innovative. Some of the recipes in the book are really, really innovative. I think, we deconstructed some things and put them back together in ways that I certainly hadn't thought of before. This is a little more, it's a naturally quick recipe, but we're combining sour cream, ricotta, egg, a little bit of sugar, flour, and relying on the natural lightness of those ingredients or the natural richness of those ingredients to provide some rise and to, it's a very, very, pancakes are fast anyway, but so it's a very, very quick, but quite luxurious recipe for such a simple one.
So this isn't one so much that we've saved time on the traditional pancake. We've taken, you have taken a fast recipe anyway and made it fancier, maybe a little more fulfilling, give a sense of accomplishment to it.
I think that's right. It's, as I said, a luxurious recipe because of the sour cream and ricotta, and it's beautiful with the orange rind. But it's not as innovative as actually the next two that we're going to talk about, I think.
Yeah, let's get to now paella. You've got a paella recipe. There is a list of foods in my head that I will happily order at a restaurant and never envision making myself. Paella, one of those foods. You've got a shrimp and tomato paella. And I'm probably saying paella wrong, but that sounds like long. Oh, good. It sounds long and complicated to me. You say, nope, 45 minutes. How do you do that?
Well, I think the first thing to think about paella, and I learned this when I went to Spain the first time, is it's basically rice with stuff in it. So if you think of rice with stuff in it, it becomes a little less intimidating. And I think we all have this weird American restaurant variation of paella in our head, which is, it has to have sausage, it has to have lobster, it has to have chicken, it has to have this, it has. In fact, it doesn't have to have anything except for rice, because what it is baked rice with stuff in it. So once you think about that, once you see it that way, I've made paella with tomatoes, I've made paella with shrimp, and this is paella with tomatoes and shrimp. There is a little bit of an innovation here, which is sort of cranking. There are two innovations here, I think. One is we warm the stock before we add it, so that that gives us a little bit of a jump start because you're not having to bring the stock up to temperature once you add it to the rice. But the second one is the oven temperature is a little higher than usual. And this does two things. It encourages a dry top, which is a nice thing in paella, and a crisp bottom, which is a very nice thing in paella. But it also makes the cooking a little bit faster. So the whole thing really is less than 45 minutes start to finish.
We're talking about great ways to cook awesome food, but, fast. And you can join the conversation. What would you like to ask Mark Bittman about cooking better, faster? Do you have some tips on ways you save time in the kitchen? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. While you're there, check out Mark's recipe for orange ricotta pancakes. We'll be back with Mark Bittman talking about his new cookbook, How to Cook Everything Fast, coming up after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about smart ways to save time in the kitchen on this edition of Food Friday. We've got award-winning food writer and author Mark Bittman with us. Do you have a question for Mark about making great food without having to take too much time, that more time than you have maybe to do it? Or do you have a time-saving strategy that you can share with us? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Mark Bittman's new cookbook is How to Cook Everything Fast. Mark, one very practical tip you give, I can't remember where I saw it in the book, take your vegetables, dice them smaller than you think. And that sounds like, it's going to take me longer to cut them smaller, but we make up the time later?
Well, everything is a trade. This is physics. There's a trade-off between surface area and cooking time. So if you take a little more time chopping, things might go a little more quickly on top of the stove. And I've taken advantage of that when it seems appropriate. In defense of not cooking fast, cooking slow can be pretty easy also, but it's a question of, do you want to wait 3 hours for things to be done? Because you can cook whole carrots, you can cook big pieces of meat, and people do, so on down the line, but that takes a lot of time. And again, I think one of the main complaints people have is that cooking takes too long.
What's your thought? My solution is often throw stuff in the crock pot in the morning, and then it's ready when I come home. I didn't look for crock pot recipes in here. Is that a problem solver for people without enough time to cook?
It is, but it's a different kind of problem solver, so it's not in here.
Gotcha.
I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of how to cook everything lazy.
That's, hey, that's my book.
Maybe that's
yeah.
not bad.
Well, one other tip that you have is instead of thinking of your meal as three separate courses, try to come up with dishes that put everything in one pan or one pot.
Well, you know, the old, what we used to call a casserole or the one pot dinner is, you know, that sounds a little corny these days, but it's still a good idea. If you're preparing, if you can figure out a way to prepare two or three things at the same time in the same process, then you're obviously saving dishes, you're saving cleanup, you're saving time.
Now we're going to get into dessert in a minute, but you make a brief but impassioned case for the importance of including dessert in your cookbook. Why is that?
Well, you know, I'm not the world's biggest dessert person, but people do like dessert, and there is something to capping off a meal with them, and they can be quick, and they can be substantial. They can make you feel like you're finished. So for all those reasons, dessert is a really terrific thing.
And that takes us to another recipe you shared with us, skillet fruit crisp. I make a lot of apple crisp because we always end up with a lot of apples in Wisconsin. I usually do it, in the oven in a pan. What is unique about this skillet fruit crisp?
You know, this one is really of the three that you chose, this is the one that I think is the most representative of the spirit of the book because it's the most innovative. And, you know, many crisps, you layer apples or stone fruit or whatever it is you like in a pan, and then you make a topping and you layer that on top. And nothing wrong with that. And then you bake that. Mm-hmm. But this technique is you cook the fruit in a skillet, which is much, much faster. And meanwhile, in a second skillet, you cook a granola-like topping. So the ingredients are not really that different from a traditional crisp, but you're doing two things at once. And, you know, it doesn't take a magician to do these two things at once. They're pretty easily done at the same time. And when you're done, you have this super crisp topping that you put over your soft, freshly cooked fruit. And it's better than a traditional crisp. That is, the topping is crisper and the fruit, you have more control over the texture of the fruit because you're watching it cook. But it is also considerably faster.
That sounds really good. And you can mix up different fruits in there is the great thing.
Well, you can do that. You know, you can do that with any crisp. But what's innovative here is cooking the two things separately. And I think, you know, I don't know, there are 2,000 recipes and variations in the book. And I think a third of them are probably I'm most proud of because they are innovative. We did really rethink some of these things, and we put them together in ways that I think are not only – we didn't do speed for its own sake. Mm-hmm. We did things that we thought were faster and better.
What are one or two that you're most proud of the innovations you came up with to still bring it in a timely fashion?
Well, I often say that fruit crisp when I'm asked that question, but since we've spoken –
we burned that one, yeah.
another is chicken parmesan, in which you, I mean, and I'll just talk through this because it'll take 30 seconds. You walk into the kitchen, you put a sheet pan in the oven under the broiler with some olive oil. You cut chicken breasts in half horizontally. You put the chicken breasts on the sheet pan. You cut some tomatoes into slices. You put the tomatoes on the chicken breasts, put them back in the oven. You grate some cheese and mix it with some breadcrumbs. You take the tomatoes, the chicken out with the tomatoes on it. You put the cheese and breadcrumb mixture on top of there. While that's crisping up and the chicken is finishing cooking, you pick some basil. You throw that on there for 30 seconds and you're done. And what you have, I don't think I've forgotten any ingredients. What you have is fully cooked chicken because you cut it in half, so it cooked more quickly, with kind of melted tomatoes, not really tomato sauce, but kind of nicely juicy melted tomatoes, and a topping that's both crisp and chewy because it has breadcrumbs and parmesan and mozzarella in it, and not overcooked basil. And I think, you know, it's a little bit of a – it's not a fire drill. There's a little bit of scrambling going on in that recipe, but it's a lot of fun, and it's less than 30 minutes, and it's really, really good chicken parmesan. And it's different. It's reinvented, and I'm quite – quite proud of that.
We heard from Marsha on Facebook. She says, we're part of the slow food, grow your own local food culture. My tip, Marsha says, is to make a menu for the week, because thawing things from our freezer is the thing that makes cooking for ourselves seem to take too long. So maybe take the time to cook when you have the time and store it for later is one solution there, Mark.
Yeah, well, the Sunday strategy, the cook as much as you can Sunday strategy is a great one, and it's a good time to make stock or to make a pot of beans or a pot of grains, and those will keep in the refrigerator all week, and you've got them to call upon whenever you need them.
Well, can you tell us a great starter recipe? Say we've got a total novice, little intimidated, like you were talking about earlier, by the existence of the kitchen, a good recipe for them to try. Low failure rates, they'll get it right, and maybe take the next step from there.
I think they're all low failure rates, but I think, you know, the way that you, Rob, were impressed by the paella thing, I think that makes it a great starting place, because it is a recipe that will work. It's impressive. It sounds much grander than it really is, and it's super delicious.
Well, I think I am inspired. I will try to make this rice with stuff in it that we call paella. Mark,
yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Happy Thanksgiving.
And to you, too. We've been
talking to
Mark Bittman on this edition of Food Friday. He is a well-known food writer, New York Times columnist. He's the author of a lot of cookbooks. His new one, the one we've been talking about, it's called How to Cook Everything Fast. We've got a great orange ricotta pancake recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.